Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 105. My name is Terry Frost, and this time on Paleo Cinema, which doesn't happen all that often, we have a guest. We have Morris from the Love That Album podcast. How are you, man?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for having me on the show, Terry. I've got to confess I've been angling for this gig for quite a while.
No, that's fine. I mean, it takes the pressure off me, so there's no downside to that. Mm. And what else are we going to do on a cold, wet, and miserable Thursday night in Melbourne?
That could certainly apply for the case for any night of the week this side of 3 or 4 months of this time of the year, for sure.
Yeah, so, everything's been kind of weird here because I've been ill. Had flu, not man flu, because I'm having an argument on Facebook about man flu. But I had genuine flu-y kind of stuff and coughing, spluttering, and not feeling well. Had a few days off work, but managed to catch up on a number of movies. And I've also found out that the illegal video people are now doing illegal Blu-rays in markets.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yes, I picked up a couple of Blu-rays, which was quite interesting.
What did you get?
Things that I wouldn't – I didn't get anything good. Mm. Actually, one of them was good, Chronicle, which is a kind of superhero found footage movie. Oh, yeah. I picked up, which is quite good. I do recommend that one. And I got the latest Underworld movie with Kate Beckinsale in it, and I couldn't make head nor tail of it. Possibly because I had a fever at the time, but I'm not willing to go back and try it again to see whether it makes any sense. Right. There were lots of vampires, her jumping backwards off buildings, and a shitload of CGI werewolves jumping on cars. That's all I remember from it.
Well, on the other hand, you could have been delusional from taking too much cough mixture.
No, I was very careful. I mean, I'm hitting the strepsils a little bit, but I'm carefully medicating with all the right things.
Right.
But hopefully I won't cough too much during the podcast recording. If I do, I can always edit it out. And I do apologize to you hearing it in your ears.
Yeah, well, there you go. In my ear holes, as Zom and Lev would have said it. Yeah.
Yep. In your head asses. Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about a couple of the movies we've seen. While I was off it, and as I said, I did see a few films, revisited a few more than anything. Let me get the Mizzo up. Let's see. I did have a day of watching movies written by Shane Black. I did. You right there?
Sorry. Now you're the one who's sick, and I'm coughing. I think I drank some tea. Went down the wrong pipe.
Okay, I'll give you a moment. I'll give you a moment.
Okay, I think I'm back.
Okay, cool. Okay, yeah, I saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't seen that, but a very close friend of mine was raving about it at the time it was on in the cinema and insisted I go to see it, and I still haven't hired that out.
It's a lot of fun. I recommended you acquire a copy of that one because, and if my voice sounds strange, it's because I've got a cough lolly in my mouth. But yeah, I mean, Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer playing off each other. Val Kilmer's playing a private eye called Gay Perry.
Mm.
And Robert Downey Jr. is this kind of petty thief who gets hooked into the Hollywood scene through a whole bunch of misadventures and meets the girl of his childhood dreams. And there's lots of good action scenes there involving a coffin and a bunch of character actors. And it's just a lot of fun. And the other thing I saw was my favorite Shane Black movie, The Last Boy Scout.
Okay. Was that the Bruce Willis? Yep. Yeah.
With Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans in it. Mm. And I really like that one. It's solid. It's a very much right down the center genre action film.
Okay.
But I like the characters in it more than anything. So I watch those. And I've got a kind of sleeper to put out there for people.
Sounds good.
Years and years ago, I saw a comedy gig. I got in for free, which is always a good thing with comedy gigs.
Oh, good. Okay.
Bobcat Goldthwait.
Oh, so hang on. So this is Made in America or
No. This is his slightly older right. one, Sleeping Dogs Lie.
Oh, okay.
Which I'll give you the basic premise because it's in the trailer anyway. This very nice girl has a very nice boyfriend. Yeah, they're in love and they're engaged. And he keeps asking her what the most transgressive thing she's ever done sexually is. And she tells him that when she was a teenager, she blew her dog.
Oh, my gosh.
And she just doesn't know why she did it. You know, it's one of those stupid things you do when you're young. Her family finds out about it, and there are all these sort of repercussions. And the weird thing about it is it's not actually about that. It's a nice film about growing up and forgiving yourself for stupid things you do as a kid.
Okay.
And finding out what's important to you and finding out who your family really is and all that sort of thing. So Bobcat throws this bomb at the start of the film.
Yep.
And then it plays out totally differently.
I mean, doesn't that tend to sort of be like a trait of maybe movies of the last 20 years or so? I know that you don't review movies of the last 20 years on paleo cinema, but I guess, you know, a lot of the trend tends to be that there's still some of that heartwarming message that only Hollywood can deliver, but, you know, done with these... the sort of shock value that only Hollywood of the last 20 years would give. It seems to be that's a common thing that's done, though, isn't it?
Yeah, this one's plays it really sweet, which is a beautiful. It juxtaposes the two things really well.
I really never thought I'd ever hear, you know, in the same sort of description, blowing a dog and really sweet in the same context. But there you go.
No, absolutely, and I see where you're coming from on that, because that's how I was in the film. But I like it. I mean, it was made for a very small budget. It's got some good jobbing character actors in it. Nobody whose names you'd know.
Yep.
But good jobbing character actors in it.
Right.
And it's an interesting film because it's unlike anything else.
Yeah, I'd say that blowing a dog. I hate to keep coming back to this, is a common theme in films, but there you go.
Yeah, how many dog-blowing films have you seen?
Well, I don't know. Put it up on the Silver and Gold Facebook page, and I'm sure you'd get 10 responses in double-quick time.
I did see one in an adult arcade in the late 1970s.
Right. I think that sort of cinema has been closed down in recent years.
Not only my mouth – well, to be honest with you, not only my mouth had a bad taste in it. But now that we've finished with dog fellatio, what have you been watching?
Well, I'll tell you what, no dog fellatio, that's for sure. Actually, that would be a good name for a band. I think if I start up a punk band, I'm liable to get that done. Okay, so...
Dog spunk or something. Dog jism.
I guess, if you know, for years we had that crappy, was it chocolate starfish?
And machine gun fellatio.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess... Dogism is, you know, pretty passé by comparison.
I think we're doing a theme here in this podcast.
Exactly. Silver and Gold, where are you when we need you? Okay, so yeah, films I've seen recently. I'll list about three or four. A couple that I've been to see in the cinema, and I can't remember if I sent you a note asking you whether you. Yeah, actually, I think I did. I went to see Cabin in the Woods at the Nova in Carlton a couple of weeks back. I don't know what I was thinking, but I took my son. He's a big horror fan, and we went down there to see that. And there's been a whole lot of hype about this, you know, saying about how inventive it is, and you know, just when you think it's going to be an Evil Dead remake, think again. And the hype for me anyway was completely justified. I found this massively entertaining, and it is a cross between the Evil Dead and another film, which if I say what that other film is, it'll give away a good part of the surprise. So I don't think I'll tell you off air, but
I think I know what it is, so that's cool.
Right, a Jim Carrey film of sorts. I absolutely loved it. I love where it went with it. It was scary in all the right places, funny in all the right places. It has Richard Jenkins in it, a lot of fun and many kudos to all those people who signed petitions and did whatever it is that they had to do to get this to be seen on the cinema screen here, because, you know, I believe it was scheduled for straight to DVD release, so I'm glad we got the chance to see this. I would have loved to have seen it at the Astor, which I think might have been the first place to show it, but still haven't seen it on the note. It's good.
Sorry to interrupt you, but while you're on the subject, the Astor is in October showing my favourite movie of all time.
Oh, which is?
The Bad and the Beautiful. Kirk Douglas, Dick Powell, Gloria Graham, Lana Turner.
So what would that be on a Sunday night, would it? Or?
It's a Sunday night one, so I'm going to be there.
Mm.
And I may mention it closer to the time and see if we can get a few people to turn up.
Oh, that'd be nice. I was actually going to be a smartass and say something like, The Wizard of Oz is showing, but I thought, no, I won't get it.
No, you wouldn't do that to me.
I wouldn't do that to you. Not on your program. On my program, maybe, but not on yours. Kevin in the Woods, yes, I mentioned. Now, I went last Saturday night. I've dragged my wife Joanne to a whole bunch of films that, you know, in the end she probably thought, meh, what did I watch that for? So I thought it was about her turn to pick something that I would go, meh. And we went to see a film, which I guess had an interesting idea. It was called Margaret. And this is another film which I think was maybe I guess it wasn't scheduled for DVD release first, but it's certainly been a few years in just lying around. It was actually made, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago or so, but is only just now getting a cinema release. Stars Anna Paquin, and I think this is made pre True Blood. And I like the idea. She plays a teenage girl, and she's set in New York. She feels partly responsible for the death of a mother and her child while she's diverting the attention of a bus driver. So this bus driver runs the mother over. So she spends a good chunk of the film trying to get justice for this run over mother. First, she goes to appeal. She tracks down the bus driver. So, look, I don't want to turn you in or anything like that, but I've gone and, you know, I tell the false story to the police because I sensed that, you know, about whether the light was green or red. But, you know, I just want to know how you feel about this. And he said, look, I didn't see you. I don't know what you're talking about. So she spends time wanting to try to do the right and honest thing. But because the film also wanted to show that in real life there are peripherals, it's not just one story going on, they spent what I thought was far too much time just, you know, talking about her relationship with her mother and father, getting stoned on pot, her first sexual experience. And, I mean, a bit of that's fine, but I don't think it really sort of labored too much what the main point of the story was, not even like in some sort of metaphorical way. The acting was great, but I think really at a 2.5 hours, I think it could have been cut down by a good 70, 80 minutes.
Looks like it's got a good ensemble there. You've got Mark Ruffalo in there, Jean Reno's in it, John Gallagher Jr., who is now in The Newsroom, Allison Janney,
yes,
Matt Damon.
And you mentioned Jean Reno, did I couldn't quite work out whether it was like a South American accent or an Italian accent, but it certainly wasn't French, and I felt a little bit sort of that didn't work.
Well, he's not French, he's Algerian.
Oh, there you go, well... Okay, well,
no, actually, he's Moroccan. I apologize. He's a Moroccan.
Oh, well,
he was born in
No, go on.
You ready? Yeah, he was born in Casablanca.
Well, there you go. So, if they're doing a remake of that,
his real name is Juan Moreno y Herrera Jimenez.
So, how about that? And I thought his accent was shit ass. So maybe it was my interpretation of his accent that was shit ass.
It was probably a Moroccan accent.
And he does the worst Moroccan accent I've ever heard.
That works for me.
Okay. In short, a good idea that it was two films. It should have been one. So cut out of 70, 80 minutes, and I think that should be a director's cut. A couple of films I've seen in cinemas recently, just very quickly, two films that I watched on DVD. Now, you'll sort of chastise me for not having watched this earlier, but only for the first time I watched Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart.
Okay, cool.
And, yeah, it was very, very fond of that. I love Jimmy Stewart. I love his sort of – he's always playing the nice guy who's, you know, he's a bit gruff, but, you know, essentially with a heart of gold. And he does this so well. And there's, especially later on in the film, there's just some heartbreaking moments. No one does it, I think, quite like he does. And just the hurt on his face when – you know, certain circumstances happen, not wanting to spoil in case, you know, there's one listener out there who hasn't watched it. He just did it so well. A lovely film. Really enjoyed it. And
He doesn't always play that, though, because in Bend in the River, he played a very dark character.
Okay, I haven't seen that. I'd like to see him play a dark character.
Try Bend in the River, okay. Anthony Mann film, 1952.
Okay.
He plays an obsessed character in that one. And I recommend that people see that. We probably should do it on the podcast sometime. Okay. I'll put it on the list here.
What's that going?
No, what were we going to say?
I was just going to say one more film I wanted to quickly mention. I mean, this is going back a few weeks ago, and I might have mentioned it to you, but it's so much on my mind. I loved it so much. You mentioned about getting films from the market. Well, I've sort of gone nuts on getting Akira Kurosawa films. And one of the ones that I watched was his film Akira. This is a long film, but it's not a single minute is wasted. Stars a guy called Takashi Shimura, who'd also been in a film that I'd seen last year called Drunken Angel. And he's absolutely wonderful. In this film, he plays a bureaucrat who finds out he's terminally ill, and he basically sets out to work out how he should live the remaining time of his life, which is, you know, estimated to be 6 months. And he wants to, after a few sort of meaningless, frivolous activities, he decides, right, he's going to go against the bureaucracy side of his job, and he's actually going to try and do something good and have a playground built for this area where the people want it. And then he dies, and then the rest of the film is spent with the parasites, either in his family or on the council, all trying to take credit for what it is that he's achieved. And so that's told partly in with some flashbacks to him, but also their story. And they're talking themselves into the ground, you know, because they have no moral legs to stand on. Just absolutely wonderful film. If you haven't seen that out there, really find a way to get it. It's just an absolute masterpiece. I know the GGTMC guys are big fans of it.
I haven't seen it, but I'm going to pick it up. Mm. He was the guy that played Kanbei in Seven Samurai as well, the older
Okay.
Samurai. Yep. Yeah, so yeah, there's a nice link, because I did Seven Samurai a while back.
I have to search out that episode.
Yeah, I did Seven Samurai, The Magnificent Seven, and Battle Beyond the Stars, because they're all the same story.
Oh, nice. All in one episode.
Yeah, well, it was an epic. I'm not going to try that too often, yeah. Yeah, and before we get into the two movies we're talking about today, I should say what they are, and I'll talk a little bit about the other podcast. But, the two movies are Night Moves, 1975, with Gene Hackman, Susan Clarke, and a very young Melanie Griffith.
I didn't see Bob Seger anywhere in there. Where was he?
He wasn't.
Oh.
I think he got inspired by it.
Lee Simon?
No, Lee Simon was not in there. Lee Simon did Night Moves as a TV clip show, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Musical clip show back in the 70s and 80s.
That's right. Oh, well, third time lucky.
Yeah, there you go. Just, it was kind of in between Happening 70 and Rage.
It was a great show. I stayed up a lot to watch them.
Yeah, and recording all the music video clips so you could play them later for people. I know the stuff.
And now you've got YouTube that sort of put all that to... put all that to rest. Don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah, don't knock YouTube. I'm going to find some very good stuff on YouTube.
Indeed.
Yep, and so they're the two movies we're doing. But I'll talk a little bit about Martian Drive-In Podcast. Mm. We now have an RSS feed for it separate from Paleo Cinema. So if you do want to listen to the Martian Drive-In, and who the hell wouldn't, you can go to either one of the websites, the paleo-cinema.com or marsdrivein.blogspot.com, and get the new RSS feed for it. I'm separating the two so I can let it stand on its own after four episodes, and it can find its own audience.
You're kicking it out of the nest.
Well, not so much kicking it out of the nest. I'm just building a condo next door.
Right. Okay.
So, I'm doing that, and that's going well too. I did the last episode about Cypher and the Man from Earth with my friends Grant and Sonia.
I did hear that one. Very entertaining. Very good.
Yeah, well, we had a bottle of Merlot, and strange things happen, and we started talking about Nicole Kidman's forehead for a while.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, but so it's going good, and I've got a couple of bits of graphics for it. So I've been getting a couple of graphic designers doing things. I even got a voicemail sent to me from the States by someone. Mm. The sound quality is better than my sound quality, which is always embarrassing.
Well, maybe he ought to do his own podcast then.
I think he must have a studio. He actually does a podcast.
Oh, okay.
But he has a beautiful setup there. But anyway, it's going well. It's building its own audience. I'm not getting as many hits as I am on Paleo Cinema, but that's okay. I'll give it time to develop. And I'm really enjoying doing science fiction films and fantasy films and horror and all those kind of genre films, because that's my other cinema love.
Good.
So, yep, I recommend that people give that a check out. So, basically, we're going to take a break for a moment now, and when we get back, we're going to talk, I think, Night Moves first, okay. And then we'll talk about the gangbuster film Ice Cold in Alex with Johnny Mills, Harry Andrews, Sylvia Sims, and Anthony Quayle.
I don't know how to do this as well as Zom and Loaf do, but when you mention Sylvia Sims, can you do a purr like? I can't do that, but
yeah, Sylvia Sims, hot.
Nom nom nom.
Yep. If you see her now, she's not so hot, but she is very much still a jobbing actress.
Oh, really?
If men must work, so must they play. And of all the brilliant podcasts in the world, none offers more in the way of relaxing V-nostalgia than Fascinating Rotcast Podcast. Many the purple-lipped pleasure seeker that sip the deep ruby wine of the internet. Cabernet and Merlot are never far away, and there is always Malbec, economical but seldom cut rate. Busy men are apt to think of Rotcast mainly as a podcast about wine, and this is true. But Rotcast is also headquarters for the Chapter and Verse Movie Quiz. Enjoy listening to a verbal description of a single DVD chapter. Blindly, you grope to identify the scene and the film. Beyond the glories of fermented beverages, past the joy that lies between the cinematic and the mysterious, you'll discover the matchless musings of a true American baby boomer. This is V-nostalgia at its best. Listen at work, if you will, but listen for play. Rotcast. Rotcast. Rotcast is registered clean, available on iTunes.
Film productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Well, Hammer means how to get a nail into a block of wood.
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Should I have said Hammer Pants?
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
I think Harry would like me to leave.
I don't think that's necessary.
I think Harry thinks it is.
Harry thinks if you call him Harry one more time, he's going to make you eat that cat.
Gene Hackman is Harry Mosby.
Hello, Harry.
In Night Moves.
Oh, come on, take a swing at me, Harry, the way Sam Spade would.
He's a private investigator.
Fly to Delhi. Would you believe Delilah? Well, she's gone.
How long gone?
2 weeks. Go find her.
Making a living.
Well, let's say $125 a day in legitimate expenses.
From other people's lives.
You can get cheaper.
Can I get better? You're hired.
Making a mess of his own.
God, you're really prime, Ellen, you know that? I catch you screwing another guy and you attack my lifestyle!
Your lifestyle has nothing to do with it!
Night Moves. It's a mystery.
I'm looking for Deli Grassner.
Deli isn't around here anymore.
With a suspect. Are also the victims.
I want to know what I walked into. Ask your wife.
Well, are we going to talk about it?
Well, it's your ball, run with it.
Where the questions.
All right, what's it all about, Mosby?
Is there still much smuggling going on around here?
The dogs have fleas.
Where were you when Kennedy got shot?
Have too many answers. Where every clue is a lie.
I've been listening to your ping pong talk long enough. What was in Marv Ellman's plane? Drugs? Was it drugs?
Night Moves.
Check. Check.
Ah, it's a beauty.
It's a game where every player is a pawn.
Harry Mosby, isn't it?
Every move is a wrong one. And the winner loses everything.
I want to know what it's all about.
I told you what it's all about.
You, what the hell are you all about?
You're asking the wrong question.
Gene Hackman in Night Moves.
Okay, and we're back, and we're going to have a chat about... Are you getting echo there?
I'm fine. Can hear you.
Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, that was a clip from Night Moves, a 1975 detective film directed by Arthur Penn. It was actually made a couple of years earlier in about 73. Had a couple of years before the studio put it out. It's got stars Gene Hackman, Jennifer Warren, Susan Clarke, Melanie Griffith, and James Woods, amongst others. And Hackman was actually nominated for a BAFTA award for this one.
Okay.
Which shows that it's got some chops. I'll just give a little bit of a plot summary from the Wikipedia. Harry Mosby is a retired professional football player working as a private investigator in Los Angeles. He's dedicated to his job, but his dedication does not make him happy or powerful in his personal life, and his wife, Ellen, is unfaithful to him. An aging actress called Arlene Iverson hires Harry to find her trust fund daughter, Deli Grasner, played by Melanie Griffith.
Unrecognizable.
Distracting Harry from his marital problems as he tracks the lascivious runaway teenager to Florida. In the Florida Keys, Harry has an affair of his own with Paula, played by Jennifer Warren, and succeeds in locating Deli, even as he learns that finding her is only the beginning of a much larger case. As the accidental deaths multiply, Harry discovers that everyone has his or her own motives, and he cannot do much to stem the tide of deep-seated depravity. There's one bit of this film that I really couldn't overcome for myself. I know you've got some issues with it, but the one that gets me, because I was shallow, is Gene Hackman's comb over.
Look, you know, I'd say that's actually quite a valid criticism. Mind you, it's fairly common. It is a 1970s film. I don't think, you know, there was the Be Bald and Proud movement of the 2000s. I don't think that had sort of developed yet. So it was seen as acceptable at the time.
Yeah, it really is weird because it varies so much the hairline. it's a weird film, but I think it's got a good ensemble in there as well. And Arthur Penn directed. He directed Hackman before in Bonnie and Clyde, because Hackman was in Bonnie and Clyde as well.
Yep.
Did movies like Mickey 1 with Warren Beatty, which I recommend highly, and a number of other good films. Let me see what else we've got on Arthur Penn. Did Missouri Breaks with Marlon Brando.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yep. Little Big Man. Bonnie and Clyde, of course. The Chase with Brando again. Mickey 1, he left-handed gun, he made that as well. He did Penn and Teller Get Killed in 1989.
Okay.
It was his last cinema release. But he didn't have a very large... He did The Miracle Worker, too, in 1962, that one about Helen Keller.
With Patty Duke.
Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft. Nice. And the movie that started a million jokes.
Yes, a whole industry. Actually, I won't go into that. I was going to mention there's a song by my favourite songwriter, Richard Thompson, who I've never been able to determine whether he wrote it about Alexander Graham Bell, and there's a line in it that he gave a hand to Helen Keller. but I don't know whether he wrote that, and I said I wasn't going to mention it, so I won't.
Yep. So, yeah, Arthur Penn directed it. It's got some – the cinematography is pretty good. And two, Bruce Surtees did the cinematography. He had a long career. He did Play Misty for Me.
Okay.
Dirty Harry, The Beguiled.
Sorry to interrupt it, but while I was watching this, and I thought, I wonder whether there was a cinematographer who was in common to films like Dirty Harry, or whether it was just an all-round – early 70s Warner Brothers film look. But even though I am a fan of Dirty Harry, but I wasn't so much a fan of Night Moves, but I couldn't help sort of thinking that there was something about the two that was similar. And now the penny's dropped if you reckon it's a cinematographer.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce Surtees did a lot of work with Clint Eastwood in particular. Did things like Honky Tonk Man, Sudden Impact, Tightrope, Pale Rider, Big Wednesday he did as well, the John Milius film. The Shooters, The Outlaw Josie Wales, Lenny. He was the cinematographer on Lenny in 1974.
Really? Okay.
Mm. So, yeah, basically he's got some chops. And the cutter on the film, the editor, was D.D. Allen, who had an incredibly fruitful career doing films. She started out doing The Hustler in 1961.
All right.
Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man again, Slaughterhouse-Five, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, The Missouri Breaks, Breakfast Club, Henry and June, The Addams Family, Wonder Boys.
That's quite a list.
It is a hell of a list. Yeah. So basically, there are a lot of people in there doing some interesting work. And, of course, this film falls deep into what they call neo-noir. And it's very much of its time in the 1970s. I mean, my viewpoint on it is it's that kind of post-Watergate, post-hippie era, everything's gone to shit and the world's corrupt kind of worldview.
Look, as I think we were speaking about before we started recording, I guess my problem with this, well, I don't know, maybe it's part of this description of being any sort of noir. I mean, I guess, you know, the traditional thing of, you know, it being a detective asked by some drunk has-been to go find a daughter, a dog, mm-hmm. a pot of buried treasure, whatever it may be, is only the start of it all. So that's what it's got in common, I guess, with other noir films. But it doesn't spend, well, I mean, as you've already gone and mentioned, it's no great spoiler to say that he finds the daughter who he's looking for inside the first 20 minutes to half hour of the film. And, you know, really that's not the whole purpose of the story. It's something a bit more sinister. Where was I going with this? A lot of it ends up being, I guess, about Harry Mosby's self-loathing sounds like such a wanky term, but a lot of his own failings. And you were going to mention, like, he discovers his wife's having an affair, and he's got his own issues because, you know, he goes and says to her at one point, well, you know, he goes and confronts her and her lover. And he's, you know, deeply resentful, as a husband would be. But then, of course, later on, he ends up, going where he finds Deli. He ends up going and having sex with Jennifer Warren. And, you know, as you would say, why wouldn't you? But, you know, he can no longer.
See the attraction.
You can no longer claim to have the moral high ground. And as a work colleague once said to me, she has qualities attractive to the superficial man.
Yep. Yeah, but also you got to remember that it's one of the great tropes of kind of detective cinema that the detectives aren't monogamous. I mean, even if you look at something like The Maltese Falcon, which I did recently for the radio gig, Sam Spade is sleeping with his partner's wife right at the start of the film.
Yeah, but he never claims to have the moral high ground. He doesn't have this wounded, hurt look like Harry Mosby does in this thing. Why did you do that to me?
Yeah. He's a very dodgy character, and he doesn't kind of confront his wife. I mean, you can tell that she loves him. Susan Clarke plays this really, really well. You can tell that she loves him, but she wants him to open up to her, to kind of let her into his internal world. Yeah. And things like he didn't tell her the fact that he was abandoned as a child, he tracked down his father. It doesn't tell her to write deep into this film that he actually did that and what happened when he did it.
Yep, that was a good story.
And when she tries to talk to him about things, he'll do things like turn on the garbage disposal unit in the kitchen.
Okay.
And distract her with jokes and sidelines to try to get her to not dig any deeper into him.
Actually, wasn't she more the one who was telling jokes? Or hang on, no, that's the Paula character, Jennifer Warren.
Paula character. Yeah. Who's doing exactly what Harry does to his wife, to Harry.
Ah, okay, so I hadn't picked up on that.
I only just picked up on it then, that she was doing it to deflect, because she's got her own reasons for deflecting, of course. She's involved in something that she doesn't want Harry to know about. And her friend, played by John Crawford, he's the ex kind of stepfather of the Deli Grasner character. She goes and moves in with him and his girlfriend, whose name is Paula, and they've got their own kind of hidden agenda as well. Everybody in this has a hidden agenda. Yeah. The lover of Susan Clarke's character, the wife, Ellen, is played by Harris Yulin, a really good character actor. Mm. Anything you see Harris Yulin, and he's got this incredible credibility about him. He doesn't look pretty. He's not a pretty boy actor, but he's a good, solid character actor. And in this, he doesn't have a large role, but he has a very important one in that he's a more attractive option than Harry for his wife, because he's more perceptive and more integrated as a human being.
Now – oh, sorry, hang on. Yeah, okay, I've gone and confused. That was Harris Yulin. I've confused him for, was it Anthony Costello who played Marv Ellman? And I've got to say, the Marv Ellman character annoyed the shit out of me with that horrible overdubbed laugh every sentence, but so that was something that got me. But yes, I take your point there about the Marty Keller character.
Yep, he's really an interesting character. And one of the other things, I was looking into this deeper and looking into a bit of the literature about the film. There are a lot of Fresnel lenses in this film, in various scenes.
A lot of what?
Fresnel lenses. They're kind of big lenses that magnify but distort images behind them.
Okay.
If you have a look when he goes to confront Marty about his affair with Ellen,
right. There's
a couple of big Fresnel lenses on the wall looking over the ocean.
Oh, yes.
And there's a couple of them in Harry's house as well. There are all these lenses that distort things.
Mm.
All the way through the film, and it just shows that it's all very symbolic stuff about how people's vision of the world is distorted by the where they stand and how they look at things.
I mean, look, I think that would certainly be a valid metaphor for a lot of noir film. I think in this case, it's not so much that Harry's vision was distorted as more he had like a blindfold put on him. He really, up until pretty late in the film, it's almost like he has no idea what is going on. He thinks that the mission is to pick up Deli, and it's really not until late that, you know, the penny drops or the light bulb clicks or pick your other cliche.
Yeah, well, not so much the penny drops as the aeroplane drops.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Indeed.
And the lovely thing is that Harry is such a flawed character. He's an interestingly flawed character from my point of view.
Very flawed. One point, this is one little bit of trivia, because, I mean, normally I'm not one on picking up jokes, but for some reason I was able to pick this one up. I'm embarrassed to say why, but there was a line in the film where I think fairly early on where he actually meets the Marv Ellman character. There's a question that's put to Harry about some old football player called Alex Karras. And yep. I thought, oh, hang on, Susan Clarke is in this. Now, I remember, you know, as a teenager, so you've got to forgive me, I went to see Porky's, and Alex Karras and Susan Clarke were both in that. And I found out later on that they did this show Webster, which I successfully and can quite proudly say I avoided, but they're a married couple. So, I thought I've gotten a film nerd joke. How about that? So,
yeah, that, I knew that one. But Alex Karras also played Mongo in Blazing Saddles.
Was that him?
That was him.
Oh, I'll have to watch that one again. Really?
Yeah.
Mongo tired.
Yeah. So he played Mongo in Blazing Saddles. So there's the interesting thing about these two films is and also Kenneth Mars is in this, and he played the Nazi guy in The Producers. Yeah. So both of these films have deceptive Nazis in them. As I said, it is a flawed film, but I do like the end of the film. I mean,
yes, I admit that was good. It's hard to say without sort of giving anything away. So, but actually, you know what? I do want to ask you a question because my lack of film literacy, but I know that you will get it. Now, there's a bit earlier in the film where Harry first discovers that his wife's cheating on him, and they're coming out of a film by Eric Rohmer. Now, I've never seen any of I have heard of him, but I've not seen any of his film. Is there something specific about that film or something specific about Eric Rohmer, or was that just by chance?
Yeah. My Night at Maud's, basically it's a thing where Jean-Louis Trintignant goes in and talks to a couple of people in a house. That's the whole movie. He talks to a couple of different people in a room. And there's that joke in the film. I saw a Rohmer film once. It's kind of like watching paint dry.
Yeah, I remember.
And that became an internet meme on Twitter.
Okay.
And now people going and saying things like, I went and saw a Tarantino film and I shot the motherfucker in the head.
Now, the meme I'm getting from my kids is, well, I would do that for you, except I took an arrow to the knee. So I have no sympathy for the whole meme thing.
Yeah.
The question I'm wanting to find out, is there anything significant about the Eric Rohmer film that they went to watch, or Eric Rohmer in particular, that was like a parallel to the main story of Night Moves?
No, not particularly. It just shows that Harry kind of is dismissive of things he doesn't know about. I think that would be the main takeaway from that.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
I think that would be the thing.
I'm trying too much into it.
Well, it's always good to try it. Sometimes you find deep stuff, sometimes you hit the bottom. Mm. But, yeah, and...
Look, I want to make a probably, while I still can, just a couple of quick points, because as you've already gone and indicated, I was probably less than impressed with this. I mean, I like the idea of it, and I like the idea of an imperfect guy, but I guess every film noir detective shows that sort of vulnerable, imperfect side of him. So I guess Harry Mosby's not unique in that regard, but, you know, really, in terms of noir history, he's no Jake Giddies. But
no, before you say that, I'll just play another clip.
Okay,
and then we'll hold that thought for one minute.
Sure.
Mind if I use your shower? Mine doesn't work so good.
Be my guest.
Pour another. Did she offer you the key to the city?
Well, no, it was more like a sightseeing tour.
How do you resist?
Oh, I just think good, clean thoughts, like Thanksgiving, George Washington's teeth.
You beating yourself?
That's a position from a game played in 1922. You play?
I know the moves.
Well, Black had a mate. I didn't see it. Queen sacrifice. And three little knight moves. Check. Check. Check.
Oh, that's nice. Show me that again. Ah, it's a beauty.
Yeah. But he didn't see it. He played something else and he lost. Must have regretted it every day of his life. I know I would have. In fact, I do regret it, and I wasn't even born yet.
That's no excuse.
So I guess the things that I had problems with the film, and you've already sort of gone and indicated that this was a deliberate decision, but I didn't like it, was the quick cut edits between scenes in the film. And it tended to happen more early in the film rather than later, but it looked that those quick cuts made it look like a television show or telemovie. Now, nowadays, you know, because a lot of things that are made for television, especially with HBO, you know, then, you know, being compared to television isn't a bad thing at all. But I guess back in those days, I kept sort of thinking, I don't know why, Streets of San Francisco or something.
Or Harry O or Rockford Files. Or something.
Yeah. So I couldn't get used to that feel, and it just felt very disjointed. There was a conversation going on, and it didn't seem to go to its natural conclusion. So I felt a bit dissettled with that. Now, one other thing, I guess, look, I don't know, this might be, I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing to confess, but I am a sucker for watching a film that will have a Lalo Schifrin score. And the Lalo Schifrin of this film was a composer called Michael Small. Look, I have to bring music into this podcast somehow.
Yeah, go on, please.
Look, I'm a big fan of Schifrin. And it started out like promising, thinking, all right, okay, it must have been the fashion of the time. Warner Brothers said, look, we can't afford Lalo this time around, but, you know, do your best. But as the film went on, it seemed like not even Schifrin light. So it's almost like, well, you know, well, if you're only going to pay me $1,000 to do this movie, then I'll put everything into the main theme, and then, you know, the rest will be library music. So I guess I saw it as a parallel to the film. Maybe, you know, they lost their nerve at some point. So, I prefer, you know, hearing the real thing in Dirty Harry or Enter the Dragon. You know, that was just where Schifrin shined, but this sort of didn't.
Really, yeah, he went a bit heavy on the vibraphone, didn't he?
I'm not a great vibe fan in that context. I like it in some jazz, I guess, but
yeah, I'm looking at the scores. This guy did. He's done some interesting films. He did Clute,
okay,
The Parallax View, yep. The Stepford Wives, The Drowning Pool, Marathon Man.
Oh, was that him? Okay,
yeah,
because I like the score for that.
Yeah, The Driver by Walter Hill. Mm. The China Syndrome. Let's have a look here. Postman Orders Twice, the second version, the Bob Rafelson version in 81. Black Widow. He did Rafelson's Black Widow in 87 as well. Yep. And let's see. Is there anything else really? Nothing enormous. He did a lot of stuff for TV after that. But
not surprising.
Yeah, definitely second string kind of composer.
Mm-hmm. So do I have any other points I want to make. I guess probably the only other thing, so like in relation to the story overall, I sort of felt that there was a big drag in the middle. So like he goes and discovers Deli down in Florida Keys, and it's like about another 30, 40 minutes before he actually returns her to her mother. I mean, so the rest of it, you know, it's just, well, I'm the detective. I've gone and found you. I might as well hang out and we can go do some night fishing or some night diving, or you know I can have sex with this woman, you know. It's not much was happening. I mean, I guess maybe they wanted to show character development, but it was the wrong part of the film for me to show that character development. It just didn't quite work. I mean, I guess there were some things that they were setting up for late in the film, particularly when Paula seduces Harry, and we find out later on it's not just because she fancies a bit of Gene Hackman love action. We find out the reason later on. Okay, fine, that's clever, but it's, I don't know, I think that's really where the film drags. Possibly once he's gone and brought her back to her mother, I guess that's where, okay, it gets a lot more interesting, but it's like they're trying to cram a whole lot of film into a rather short period of time, so...
Yeah, that, when he brings her back to her mother, that's when shit gets serious.
Yes, definitely.
So but, that's all my notes. I mean, I think it's a flawed film. I don't think it's perfect. And I think that Arthur Penn was trying to be a bit too smarty pants with it. But there are a lot of things about the film that are very typical of the time. And I think that I think the editing is good, but I think there's something about the script that needed tightening or reorganizing a little bit. Yes. To pump up, I mean, giving him more of a motivation of sticking around, apart from the fact that he wanted some pussy. But yeah, I mean, I think Hackman's good in the film. I think Susan Clarke's very good.
She is,
and the ensemble works. But I think the thing you take away from it, the people most remember, apart from Jennifer Warren's nipples, was the ending, which I can't give away too much. It takes place on a boat and involves treasure hunting.
Yes.
And it involves Harry realizing his limitations.
Definitely. And, that was very metaphorical. That
And they keep mentioning your chess game, a very famous chess game.
Oh, now that's something I forgot to mention. You watch any film that's got a chess game or a train going in the distance and you're thinking, right, there's a metaphor for something here. But
he talks about the chess game where the guy made a move, but it wasn't the right move. There were two or three other moves he could have made, but he didn't see the obvious.
Yes, okay, so...
There's your metaphor.
Indeed.
Harry makes the moves he thinks are right, but he doesn't see what's obvious.
Right, yep. That's
which leads to the climax of the film.
Indeed.
But, I mean, I think it's a watchable film. I think it's a very interesting one from a certain point of view.
Oh, look, I never found myself falling asleep during it, and you know, as you say, it is flawed. I wouldn't even necessarily say it was a bad film, and certainly for the last third in particular, I found myself quite riveted to what was going to happen. But I just think it took an awfully long time to reveal what the whole purpose of the story actually was.
Yeah, and I think that they went a little bit heavy on the fact that they wanted to put in the post Watergate. The kind of depression that America went through.
Yeah.
I think they put a little too much social context into it, and it weighed down the story a little bit.
Yeah, I guess though that might have been a common thing of some other films at the time. I mean, I guess...
Well, The Parallax View, for instance, and films like that where there's kind of intense paranoia.
Well, The Conversation.
The Conversation as well, yeah, those intense paranoia things. They're very much of the time now, the way that a lot of films are now, that talk about privacy issues and things like that.
Yeah, very much.
But anyway, we'll take another break, and when we get back, we'll talk about a nice 1958 black and white British war film.
Sounds like fun.
Ice Cold in Alex.
North Africa, the battlefield of giants. The Eighth Army, Rommel's Africa Corps. 2 million men in all the ebb and flow of this epic struggle. 2 million men, 2 million stories. This is one. It happens to be true.
Stop!
sharp, judgment blurred by exhaustion and rattled nerves. His one determination to make Alexandria before they were killed or captured.
I'm a drunk, you know that, don't you?
You were trying to get us away.
The next drink I have is going to be a lager. Ice cold.
But Alex was a long way off. There was a whole desert between them. 600 miles of treacherous burning sand, of unknown dangers.
There's something under my foot.
This is Sister Murdoch, who got left behind when the nurses pulled out of Tobruk. Mr. Pugh, the Sergeant Major, a good man to have around in a tough spot. And Captain Vanderpoel, who catched a lift for reasons of his own.
What do you keep in that pack?
Gin. Want some?
A vast, empty desert, suddenly filled with suspicion. A harsh and terrible land that becomes a rendezvous for two lonely people in search of tenderness. A few stolen moments despite the face of war.
In a few days, you'll have forgotten we ever met.
I won't forget.
It's no good, sir. What do you mean, no good?
It's the engine. It's boiling over. It's heating. And the siege engine won't get us to Alex.
So you all want to walk, do you? All right.
There's the compass. Take all the food and water you want. Keep on 30 degrees for 2 days. And I hope it keeps fine for you.
Throw it to me. Hurry. I'm being sucked under.
Hang on, man. Move.
Okay, that's the intro to Ice Cold in Alex, a 1958 British film based on a novel of the same name by Christopher Landon. It's directed by J. Lee Thompson, and it's got a nice, small British ensemble cast. John Mills, Sylvia Sims, Anthony Quayle, and Harry Andrews almost covers it. Four people in a desert in an ambulance. I'll just do a little bit of a plot synopsis. In fact, I have two. A group of army personnel and nurses attempt a dangerous and arduous trek across the deserts of North Africa during the Second World War. The leader of the team dreams of his ice-cold beer when he reaches Alexandria, but the problems just won't go away. That's one of them. The other one says, an ambulance crew is separated from its unit when evacuating a North African base in World War II. John Mills is in command. Along their travels, they run across a man who appears to be a brusque South African soldier. So that's pretty much it. So Ice Cold in Alex. It's in black and white. It was filmed in Libya as well. So it's got the beautiful location shooting. Directed by J. Lee Thompson, who did a whole bunch of things, including a lot of later films with Charles Bronson.
Okay. I mean, look, I personally fell nuts over the fact when I realized that this is the same guy who did the original version of Cape Fear, which to me is just about the scariest film I've ever seen.
Yep, good old Bobby Mitchum.
Max Cady,
one of the greats. Let's see, I'll find some of the other things he did, which there should be a list here somewhere. Mm. He did a whole bunch of things in England. The movie he did before this was called Woman in a Dressing Gown.
Oh, really? And what? I wonder what the sequel to that was. You know, Child in a Pair of Pajamas or something.
He also did the Guns of Navarone as well as Cape Fear.
Okay.
Kings of the Sun, which is an Inca movie with George Chakiris and Yul Brynner in it.
Wasn't it a Melbourne heavy metal band too?
The Koala Beam.
Mm, yeah. Okay.
McKenna's Gold, The Chairman, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. He did that as well.
I saw that at the drive-in. I think about 10 years old, and we went to the drive-ins to see that. That's, I think, the first drive-in film I ever saw.
And he did a shitload of later Charlie Bronson films.
Okay.
From the mid-70s onwards. So, you know, a good jobbing director. Mm. But Ice Cold and Alex, let's look at the characters you've got. You've got Captain Anson, played by John Mills. Mm. He's been captured by the Germans before. He went 2 days across the desert without water to get away from them. And basically, he's shell-shocked.
He's battle-fatigued.
He's battle-fatigued to buggery. Mm. He's drinking too much. He can't sleep. He's making bad decisions, which he inevitably does during the course of the movie as well. And he's just at the end of his tether. Now, you've got him for starters. You've got the sergeant, played by Harry Andrews, Pugh, who's in charge of all the ambulances and all the mechanics at the base, gets lumbered in with there. He's a good, solid character. Understands the background for Captain Anson. He explains it to the other characters in the film.
Look, the point I wanted to sort of make about him, I mean, I guess you could say this for all the four major characters, but where you first see Harry Andrews come in, and he's telling off a soldier for doing some shoddy mechanical work in repairing one of the ambulances on the base, and you sort of thought, all right, he's going to be the stereotype British Army officer, World War II. Oh, you do that wrong again, and you'll be in for you'll be in for it. And you sort of think, all right, okay, he's going to be a fairly two-dimensional, flat cardboard character, and he's anything but. That's really, I think, more than anything else, I don't consider this so much a war movie as a character study. And I think it's, all these four characters could quite easily just been repetitions of everything that had ever gone on before in a British World War II film, but they're completely three-dimensional. I believed in them. I cared about every one of them.
Yeah, and I did Harry Andrews when I did The Hill last time as well. Totally different character. Both military officers in North Africa, but two totally different characters.
Okay.
And I really into Harry Andrews' life. Interesting guy. He's got to be the butchest gay man in cinema.
Is he?
Well, he used to be before he died.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Was he?
Yes, he was. He's the butchest Nancy boy in cinema. Really, I mean, yeah, he's got lantern jaw. He's got jug ears. He's an enormous sort of guy. And a fantastic character actor. He's just anything you see him in, Harry Andrews, is worth watching.
Now, so I presume that, you know, because of their age, that John Mills and Harry Andrews and Anthony Quayle probably would have actually, you know, been in the war for all that, and that would have informed their characters to some extent, I imagine.
Anthony Quayle, I think, did some intelligence work. I've just got my Anthony Quayle paper here. But here, Peter, see, during World War II, he was an army officer and made one of the area commanders in the auxiliary units. Later, he joined the Special Operations Executive and served as a liaison officer with the partisans in Albania.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, he had some chops. I think Johnny Mills did a little bit in the war too. Let me see what I got on Harry Andrews, because it'd be interesting to see if they've got backgrounds on this. Mm. Okay, let's see. He was in the Royal Artillery during the Second World War.
Well, there you go.
And let's see what Johnny Mills has got.
That's real method acting, though, isn't it?
Yep. Let's see. He was in the Royal Engineers.
Okay.
Johnny Mills. So they all had chops. I think Sylvia Sims was a little bit young to have been in the war.
Yeah, I...
in any kind of role. Mm. But yeah, I mean, these guys did have the background. They knew their stuff instinctively. Mm. They didn't have to act it. They lived it in some ways.
Mm. And that's probably why I guess we feel so much compassion and we really give a shit about these characters. If the same film had been made today with people who were merely actors, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's an unfair assessment. But yeah, look, this was... a story where you had to care about the characters. You wanted them to make that journey, and you wanted them to, you know, succeed. I mean, they had the desert, and effectively there are two characters that we haven't mentioned yet, and one is the desert, and one is Katie, which is the name of the ambulance that they're driving.
Well, we haven't mentioned the other two characters, Sylvia Sims and Anthony Quayle.
Oh, well, let's do it.
Yeah, Katie the ambulance, you've got, and the Libyan desert. Mm. But Sylvia Sims' character is a nurse Murdoch, and she's basically good at her job. And tough too. There are actually two nurses at the start of the film. One of them is shot by the Germans. It's not too much of a giveaway to say that.
Fairly early on.
But what Sylvia Sims does when that girl gets shot in order to save them from the Germans...
So clever, yeah.
...is intelligent and tough. I mean, they were close friends, but the toughness she shows in that is great. And it's also a strong female role for that reason, that they showed that the nurses during the war, and if you read into the history of this at all, there were some incredibly tough women during World War II doing some incredibly difficult things.
Yeah.
And I think Sylvia Sims portrays that really, really well.
Yeah, she sure did.
And then you've got the interesting character, Captain Vanderpool, played by Anthony Quayle.
Vanderpool.
Vanderpool, who comes in wearing shorts and carrying a bag full of gin. Yep.
That's got to be the worst South African accent I've ever heard in a film. Not that I've heard that many South African accents in films.
I've heard worse. Really? But well, there's a reason why it's a bad South African accent.
Yes, there is. But
he's great. He's a big hulking character. He throws jerry cans around like they're lunch boxes. And he swaggers and he's very confident. And as these people creep across the desert, because the bridge to get them to Alexandria has just been blown by the Corps of Engineers to stop the Germans using it, they have to go down through the Qatar Depression, which is a kind of dry, briny swamp.
I thought there was such an apt name for that area, the Depression, and it sort of serves as a good metaphor for John Mills' character. He swings between bouts of yes, we can do this, yes, let's all work together, to I'm ready to give up, what on earth made me think that we could actually do this, just fuck off the lot of you.
And there's some great action set pieces in this film. There are a number of them. I mean, you've got the bit where they've got to walk through the minefield on the trail of vague tracks and through the minefield. And the
photography in that scene is absolutely incredible, because you see where Mills and Anthony Quayle are walking through there to lead Harry Andrews, to drive the ambulance through there. And the photography from the ground perspective, where you see the tire, and I mean, that there's no more film to go if it goes on the mine, but I still believe that there was half a chance it was going to go on the mine. It was so well done and so beautifully photographed.
There's a bit where they dislodge one of the mines with the sand being dislodged by the truck tire.
Yes.
And the mine looks about the size of a garbage can.
Oh, yeah.
It's all done with perspective, and there's a really tense moment where something appears to go wrong, it's deeply and seriously wrong, when they're walking through the minefield, and that's just done incredibly well, and it shows, and it's one of the good things that demonstrates a couple of things, one of which is that Vanderpoel is courageous in his own way, even though he's braggart, it does bring him down a peg or two, but it also shows that Captain Anson, when the chips are down, can do tough and difficult and dangerous things.
Completely. Because there was a scene early on, like before they leave the camp, and there was the other officer who Anson said, he's the one who should make the journey. I'll stay behind and guard the camp, which might have meant certain death for him. When he ends up getting the straw to make the journey and giving him a chance of survival, getting to British lines, this other officer effectively accuses him of, you had a good word in the commander's ear, you get this feeling that Anson is he's less than noble after all, even though he's done nothing that you've seen, but really, time and time again, you see he's really the personification of morality and nobility. Mm. He's great, really very good character.
And they got Liam Redman doing a little cameo as the brigadier, who's a total fucking nutter and shouldn't be where he is.
Yeah, well, he gets his.
He's in the bathtub and he's talking about things. He's making decisions on the hop, not based on any reality.
You know what? It just made me to think of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the commander of that ship that's heading towards Earth. He's always sitting in the bathtub, and I don't know. He looked like him.
Maybe they based it on Liam Redman in Ice Cold and Alex. You don't know.
I'm sure. I'd like to think so, but Douglas Adams isn't going to tell.
No, he's past telling. I met him once, by the way.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Oh, he came to Australia.
Did a signing in Sydney. He's quite a nice guy.
Okay.
But anyway, getting back to it, and the ensemble there is great, and Vanderpoel and helps them through a couple of interactions with the Nazis by saying that they're an unarmed ambulance and that they've got to get through. Mm. They turn up at an oasis.
Yes.
And suddenly they're surrounded by Arabs with enormous long rifles. Mm. One of whom speaks with a very fine British accent.
Yeah, that was quite a funny moment.
Yeah. It was, because he's actually undercover. That actor's an interesting guy, Peter Ahn. Interesting character actor. Did a whole bunch of different stuff. He was murdered in his own house.
Oh, really? Under what circumstances?
He did tend to take younger gentlemen into his home for various assignations.
Okay.
And it could have been one of those kind of things that these days would be called a gay panic
right.
thing, or it could have just been someone trying to rob him. They never actually found out. But he was killed in his own home in 1983. But anyway, getting back to it, I like Peter Arn in that because it's a very sly, jokey, little interesting cameo in the desert. And then, of course, they've got to go through the Qatar Depression, which has got a thin crust over what's basically a salty swamp.
And well, that sort of ends up leading to an incredible set piece with Anthony Quayle and sinking into a swamp.
Yeah, and sinking the quicksand, basically. That's what quicksand actually is. It's that kind of desert sand which sucks you down.
Look, I really loved you come out at the end of the film realizing that they could not have gotten to Alexandria. And I mean, look, I've given it away, but really this is not about the end. It's about the journey that they make. So, you know, they have to have that ice cold. But it seems like they would never have gotten there without any one of them not being there. You've already gone and cited the Sylvia Sims character's pragmatism and ingenuity.
Yeah.
Vanderpool's bravado and strength. I mean, there's a lot that he does is absolutely fucking stupid. But his strength and his and he got them, well, for reasons which you find out later, he got them out of trouble with the Germans, and yeah, and there were other moments, but his bravado, I think, got them through a lot. And I guess Harry Andrews' character, because this is part of what I was talking about before, about his three-dimensional character, he could have been just, you know, the barking British officer, but really he has a lot of compassion, and when he realizes that Anson is on the source, he cares very much, not just because Anson could jeopardize their journey, but because he gives a damn about him as a human being. He really cares about him.
And he understands why he's there, and he knows that the army's fucked him over by putting him there.
Yeah, exactly.
And lovely bit of writing, lovely bit of characterization there. And it's a great bit with Vanderpool underneath the car.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was I was watching that.
Under the ambulance,
What's going to happen? Oh, is this the end? Is this the end? It was, I mean, and that really sort of makes the point further that all these set pieces in the film, they're incredibly tense. Now, I'm just sort of going to do a little digression here. Film that I'm very embarrassed to say I haven't seen, shame on me, but one of my very good friends, it's his favorite film. I'm talking about Wages of Fear. Now, it was.
I'm going to do that in the podcast.
Okay, well, look, so, I mean, did Wages of Fear come before or after this?
It came before, and we're talking about the original Wages of Fear, not the William Friedkin.
Yeah, no. I'm talking. Yeah, the original one. So, because for everything that I hear is that it's just continual heart pound city, and really this film is, you know, completely. Oh my God, what's going to happen next? And I'm wondering whether Wages of Fear would have been some sort of inspiration for how this film was shot, because
I could see that, because there's a lot of the characters are very different, but the situations have a similarity to them, not in the fact that they're all of the environment, the things that could plausibly happen. Yep. They show the resourcefulness, and they outline character. Mm. But this one, Vanderpool's underneath there where they've got to do some work under the ambulance, and the stones they've got, because they don't have two jacks, the stones start crumbling, and Vanderpool's got to basically hold up the ambulance until they can get the jack under it.
Mm.
Otherwise, the diff's going to crack, and they won't be able to get anywhere in the ambulance. Mm. And, yeah, that's an incredible piece of work, and nice acting too.
Oh, it was absolutely superb. I've got to say, just sort of coming back to Anthony Quayle for a second, because you're mentioning it, the only other thing that I've seen him in, and you probably would remember this, was when he was as the host of, I think it was an Australian show, called The Evil Touch. And I remember watching that, I think maybe as a 9 or 10 year old on television. And he always used to open, I guess for those of you out there who don't remember this or haven't seen it, I don't even know whether it showed outside of Australia, but he'd always open the show, I guess Rod Serling style, talking about the story. They're all self-contained stories. And at the end of every show, he'd say, and this is Anthony Quayle reminding you that there is a touch of evil in all of us. And I sort of saw him as this, you know, very suave, sophisticated gentleman with, you know, with this sense of the macabre. And, you know, forgetting the bad South African accent aside, I found it hard to reconcile the image of that guy in The Evil Touch with this very macho, very swaggering sort of character that he plays in Ice Cold and Alex.
If you go to YouTube, you can take a look at the episodes of The Evil Touch.
Oh, are they on YouTube?
They're on YouTube.
Oh, well, I'm just about to relive my childhood here. That's fantastic.
There you go, yep.
So, until we meet again, this is Anthony Quayle saying there is a touch of evil in all of us.
And also, toward the end of his life, when he did The Evil Touch, he had a few health issues as well.
Okay.
So if he looks significantly different, age is one reason, and also ill health, unfortunately, was another. But, yeah, in this one, he's fantastic in the film. Mm. Nicely modulated role. Basically, they're onto him fairly quickly without saying what they're onto. Mm. Everybody else is onto him fairly quickly, but they need everybody they can get among the four in order to survive. And then they've got that great last set piece when they've got to basically take out the spark plugs, use the crank at the front of the ambulance, and in order to get over an enormous sand dune, basically hand crank the entire ambulance over the dune. That's a heartbreaking, tough piece of work.
I was going to use that very word, heartbreaking, but... But yeah, then Anson, I guess, you know, comes into his own after the moment of heartbreak, and they just say, right, let's just do it again,
yep.
It's so clever. I guess the problem with a lot of films, or the potential for a problem with road movies, and I guess the fact that this doesn't have a road, but it is a road movie. Because there are all these individual set pieces, there's very much a danger that it could just be seen to – you there, Terry? I heard the Skype loop. Okay. So there's very much the danger that this film could sort of end up being just a sum of really good bits. And this does have a whole lot of set pieces, but it really worked cohesively. This was their mission. They had to get there, and one set piece flowed very nicely into the next, and they really avoided any issues of it looking just like a film with a whole lot of good set pieces. It really was one film, and just for me, worked really brilliant. I love it. I really love it.
It's a fantastic film. And also the ending, too, when they get to Alexandria, has two or three beautiful grace notes in it.
I believe that actually got made into an ad. Is that true? The core of that scene when was it Carlsberg decided that they were going to advertise, and they used footage from that scene. Is that right?
They could well have done, because it's a great scene. And just the sight of that beer with the beading on it after all of these scenes in the desert where they're basically short on water, short on everything but food probably. They've always got tea as well because apparently there's an enormous bag of tea that the guys leave in the ambulance. They got some.
Yep.
And just that beautifully evoked ice-cold beers lined up on the bar. Mm.
And, you know, the thing that I like is – it could very well easily have just ended there, but you still have one more moment of tension even after they've earned that reward, and I thought that was a really great touch.
Absolutely, and I think it's a reasonable touch too, because in spite of differences people might have in that situation, they had a commonality about them, and they had worked together under extraordinary, heartbreakingly tough circumstances.
I think also because the film was made like 13 years after the war, that maybe they were able to sort of make that
perspective.
And it works
really well as a film. I mean, I saw this when I was a kid.
Oh, right.
One of those late night television things where you sneak up and watch movies. Mm. And it's just a very tough little film. It's not as well known as a lot of other war films of its time. But it's one of those things that the Brits did really well in the 40s and 50s, which is telling stories of their recent past.
Yeah. Well, I will say, even though I've gone and said how absolutely brilliant and how much I loved it, I will make note of one minor thing that they shouldn't have done. But I think even this was sort of fluffed over so quickly, it's not a big deal, but there was like a potential of love interest between the Mills character and the Sylvia Sims character, and I don't know, maybe he had it written into his contract, I want to get it on with Sylvia Sims, and once again, why not? But as far as the story goes and as far as their characters work, maybe that didn't need to be there, but you know, pretty much by the next set piece, when he goes and says something to her, you know, quick, get on with it, love, you know, don't worry about this lovey-dovey stuff, just get on with it, and he's woken up to his senses, and I thought, well, phew, you've redeemed yourself.
But there's also the bit where she says, you don't know me.
Oh, really? I don't remember that.
Yeah, there's a little bit in there where he says, you know, I'd be bad for you, there's really nothing there, I mean, you know, I'm not good for anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And she says, well, you don't know me.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, the way the characters are set up, maybe something will come of it, maybe they won't. But I think that she's tough enough to see him through something like the kind of breakdown somebody has in those horrible circumstances that Captain Anson finds himself in.
Yeah, for sure.
But, yeah, that's the romantic in me, I suppose. But whether it does or not, they've got a great ensemble, a fantastic little war story played with basically four actors, essentially.
I mean, we've already gone and mentioned the name Katie of the ambulance, but really, yeah. Katie is a valid character because everything that happens to them, you see through, you know, their adventures in the ambulance. You know, Katie is shot at by the Germans. She has an axle, you know, break or nearly break.
Yep.
They have... They're running out of water. Washer. The washer. Just so many things happen to her, and you want her welfare as much as you want the rest of them because their fate's tied in with Katie. So,
every 20 minutes to cut the ambulance overheats, so they've got to stop for a while.
Yep.
And refill it with water. Most of the water goes in the ambulance rather than them when they're short of water because they need that life supply line. Mm. It's just it's just done beautifully well, and you can tell that the guy who wrote it and the people who actually was an ambulance driver during World War II really knew their stuff and knew about those ambulances and knew what made them work and what didn't. Christopher Landon, his name is, that kind of first-hand knowledge isn't something that we get now unless it's some people who are in, say, Afghanistan or Iraq start writing action films. But because that kind of national service almost was ubiquitous in England in the 1940s, it had to be of its nature.
True.
Everybody worked for the war effort. That first-hand knowledge and credibility really shines through in the film. There's not a false note of anything to do with the environment, the military, or anyone else in the film.
Yeah.
And now we're so
distanced from it, it'd probably be hard to make a film that wasn't set in Iraq. That could be the only sort of first-hand conflict that we could do. We're so distant
from losing a lot of those people from that generation. We don't have the resources that they had in those days to tell these stories. But yeah, it's a kick-ass little action film. A good character piece as well. It's 129 minutes, so it runs over 2 hours. And it flies by.
Definitely. When you sent this to me, and I was thinking, two and a bit hours. Oh, yeah, a war film? Okay. And really, by the end of the film, I was thinking, I could have gone with another half hour, I think.
Absolutely. And one of the other things, too, is you've got to remember it's a war film. None of the main characters do anything violent, really.
That's true, because they have their guns relieved of them.
They have their guns relieved of them. They're not fighting a war. They're basically trying to... They're part of a retreat, and they're broken off from the rest of the retreating army. Of course, later on, they retook all those areas, as everyone knows. Mm. But they're basically running away.
Yes.
And yet,
I guess that's why I don't really see this as a war film. It is a film set during wartime and a character piece. But because there are action sequences, but it's not battle sequences. We're not talking about A Bridge Too Far or Wild Geese or something like that.
But the good thing is they have some fantastic explosions in spite of that.
Yeah, that's true.
When the Germans come in and bomb the minefield to clear the way for their tanks.
Yep, that's true.
And blowing up the bridge.
I actually, and, so there's this bit where they blow up the bridge, or the British engineers blow up the bridge earlier on in the film, and it's like a genuinely funny pair of lines, but it also speaks volumes about the Harry Andrews character and the John Mills character. So they see the bridge get blown up, and then the brigadier the brigadier gets blown up, and John Mills says, "My gin," and Harry Andrews says, "My toolkit." And it just speaks volumes about
because they're both in the car with the brigadier. Yeah,
absolutely. And the pragmatism of the Harry Andrews character and the dependent on the alcohol nature of John Mills is just those four words. It just spoke everything about the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And both of them transcend that. I mean, Harry Andrews makes do with the toolkit he's got on the ambulance, and John Mills makes a promise that he's not going to drink again, even though there is alcohol with him, until they can have an ice cold beer in Alexandria. Mm. That's it. That's his carrot on the stick to get him through this stuff, and it works.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, a fantastic little film. So that's about it. I reckon we've pretty much drained that one dry.
I think so.
That glass dry.
I think so. Oh yes, I think I feel like I want to have a beer now, but I don't think we have any. Damn.
No, I think we're out as well. Damn, we should have done that. Plan this a bit better.
All right, you know what? I'm making a journey to Sunday when you put this on online, Terry, and I'm going to make sure that I have an ice cold in my house while I listen back to the podcast.
Sounds like a plan. Anyway, that's about it. I'll do the feedback after I say goodbye to you.
Okay.
Because I've got to do it all separately with the editing nature of podcasts. But thanks very much for being on here, Mark.
Absolutely.
I really
pleasure.
Appreciate you. Really appreciate your help on this, and I'm glad we got a couple of films that we could chew up and spit out at people.
Thank you very much. No, it was really, really a pleasure. And I mean, I've gone and told you many times, you know, that yours is one of the very first podcasts that I listened to, and right from the word go, I thought, wow, you know, I'd love to do what this guy does. Hey, I think I can. And so your show was absolutely complete inspiration to me. And
well, thank you.
Really appreciate that.
Okay, give yourself a plug for your podcast.
Okay, thank you. So I host a show called Love That Album, and you've played my promo quite a number of times, so I'm sure the listeners have heard of it. But basically the idea is every episode I pick one album, occasionally two, but generally one, and I break it down pretty much the way, I guess, yourself and some of the other film podcasters break down film. Go, you know, maybe talk about song by song, what the themes are, what some of the common themes are around the album. It's less about the who played on this track and who played on this album and, wow, isn't that great. But I tend to sort of look heavily on the lyrics side. And one of my co-presenters, I tend to get someone different every time, but one guy who's come back quite a lot is a fellow called Michael Persh. I'll do a plug for him, sitting in a bar in Adelaide podcast. But you know, we basically sort of like think we're a good match. He's very much a music description person, and I'm more of a lyric sort of person, although we go into each other's territory. But anyway, so that's basically the idea. I've just recorded episode 27, I think, which is covering Los Lobos's Kiko album, and that's going to go online, I think, in a week and a half from when we're speaking. I've just been having so much fun doing it, and you know, basically train trips into and out of work, spent writing notes and you know for what I want to talk about in the podcast, and it's just been an absolute bundle of fun, really. Really enjoyed doing it. So thanks very much for allowing me to plug that. Oh, sorry. And if you do wish to hear it out there, you can go to lovethatalbum.blogspot.com or look up all one word, Love That Album in iTunes.
Absolutely. And I recommend that people do that. So thank you for that. And I will catch up with you later on, obviously, because we can email each other at work.
We can have an ice cold in Mel.
We can do that. And we will do a catch up as well, FaceTime.
Sounds good.
But thanks for that. And that's about it, and I will come back after a music break. I'll chuck some music in here and do the feedback.
Okay. See you, Terry.
See ya.
Beneath the bow before. do they sing with voices loud and clear. Queen of hearts, every time you wink your eye, the fellows sigh, you'll hear them cry as they implore you.
And they implore you.
Queen of hearts, when you're walking down the street, you look at sweet, so trim and neat, they bow before you.
They bow before you.
She doesn't need a crown.
Queen of hearts, everything for everything, and every soldier, every man, they adore you. They adore you.
Don't be hesitating. If you want to lose your care, follow the throng and drive your blues away. Crowds are congregating. There is music in the air. What is the song? The band begins to play.
Queen of hearts.
That was Gracie Fields with Queen of Hearts from the movie of the same name, which is available on YouTube, just to show you that it wasn't all good during World War II. Let's get on with the feedback. Actually, there is only one piece of feedback for Paleo Cinema. The Marshall Drive-In podcast is currently getting a lot of love, but Joe Bean did a brief Facebook message about the Mondo Connery episode of Paleo Cinema. Said, love Sean Connery, never heard of the 2-year review, but I'm going to find them. Thanks, Joe. I think finding obscure Connery is quite interesting, particularly when he wasn't just kind of cashing checks. That 60s period is a really interesting one in his career. So I recommend that people do search out obscure films by actors you like, particularly if they are kind of big stars. Find the things that weren't successful, the things that really fell between the cracks, and it happens with every artist, every actor. There are projects that just don't gel for some reason, but they always have features of interest, and it's just, I like people who are trying to do something different when they don't really have to. I mean, things like George Clooney doing The Descendants, he could be doing suave motherfucker roles all the time, but he chooses not to, and I like that, and I respect that. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. We've run over an hour, which I kind of like, almost an hour and a half so far. Anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another Martian Drive-In podcast, but please, please, please remember, Martian Drive-In podcast now has its own RSS feed. You should be able to subscribe to it through iTunes now, and I would like you to do that if you are into genre films. But anyway, I'll be back in 4 weeks' time with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Take care of yourselves, enjoy your movies, and if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, stay cool. If you're down here, stay warm. Oh, yeah, and I should apologize for my voice during this podcast. The kind of flu bug I've got really did fuck me around, and I am not at my best. So anyway, take care, and I'll catch you guys in 4 weeks or 2 weeks, depending on your inclination. Bye.